There's the old saying, be sensitive or gentle to those around you because each of them is fighting a great battle of which you have no understanding. And I think if we have a better sense of where they come from, we are going to be able to get along with them better and perhaps mine some of the riches that they have to offer that we wouldn't otherwise be open to.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. If you live long enough, you will have some events in your life that are milestones, in the sense that there is a before this happened and after this happened. And sometimes those could be small personal things, before I got sick, after I got sick, or happy events, before I got married or after we had the baby. Our guest today has one of those events that the whole world was aware of, the eruption of Mount St. Helens. But unlike the rest of us watching on TV screens and listening on the radio from a safe distance, he was in a helicopter reporting on the event and was intimately aware of the loss of life happening right before his eyes. How do you deal with something so huge? In the case of Jeff Renner, you can turn to faith and prayer. Jeff Renner is a 9-time Emmy Award winner, having served as a science journalist, documentary producer, and chief meteorologist at Seattle's King Television for 39 years. He's executive producer and host of the television program Challenge 2.0, available as a podcast, which focuses on faith and wisdom traditions, seeking to stimulate interfaith dialogue.
Not long after I got to Seattle, and I grew up in Wisconsin, more or less, so there aren't many hills or mountains there, unlike Utah and like Washington State. My bosses said, we want you to take a mountain climbing class in Mount Rainier. And it was like, okay. Well, it turned out that volcanoes were beginning to get active. First, they thought Mount Baker was going to be active, later Mount St. Helens. And I was the one that was assigned to literally camp out at those locations. And at first, it was like a reporter, a science journalist dream. I had a helicopter at my disposal. I was living literally in one of the beautiful places of this planet. But we began to see this shift. We began to see deformation of Mount St. Helens. We began to see ash, cracks in the glaciers. And then May 18th, 1980, it erupted. And it was our job. We had one crew that was flying high to get the big sense. But it was my job with my photographer, Mark Anderson, and our helicopter pilot to track just above the rivers where we had mud flows that were moving at speeds of 45 miles per hour. We tracked that with the helicopter. And it was a consistency of wet cement. And every so often we'd have to retreat because of ash flow. And I was later told we had lots of close calls. Our job ended up not only covering the volcanic eruption, but also in searching for survivors or locating bodies. And without going into great detail, I will tell you that when you encounter someone that was a victim of the eruption, that it was exposed to 850 degree blast temperatures, it's not a sight you're going to ever forget. It impacts you deeply. And having lost friends that I knew down at Mount St. Helens, I began to ask why them and why not me, what you might call survivor's guilt. But I began to see that there was a bigger picture. And along with that awe and wonder that I experienced as a pilot, and just in covering the fields of science and the environment, I also began to ask, what more is being expected of me? And that played very definitely in deepening my Christian faith and in beginning to look at how I could serve my community in whatever ways I might to a greater depth and to a greater degree.
That's a really interesting description of a sense of, I guess I would say, a sense of calling. It doesn't say exactly what to do, but it says, I need to be aware and do more or use what resources I have.
I think, Steve, that as you begin to be open to that, I think God is not intrusive, and you were asking me about what sense I have of God. I like the saying that was St. Bonaventure, and I think another mystic, Nicholas of Cusa, who said, God's center is everywhere, his circumference is nowhere. And I don't view him as being intrusive at all, but when you're ready, when you're open, I think you're going to get that literal tap on the shoulder saying, you might consider doing this. And I think that openness, as I would interpret it, to the Holy Spirit, can lead you in unexpected places that you then follow in unexpected ways.
And as far as stories, I wonder if I could go back with you, kind of your origin story. Did you grow up in a house where faith was an ever-present thing, or was that something later in life?
I would say I grew up in a household, Steve, where faith was important. We were not intimately involved with a faith community at that point. My father had served in World War II. He had been a medic in New Guinea and the Philippines, and anybody that's familiar with that era knew that they were areas of intense warfare. He was a medic, and so he had to deal with a lot of the fallout from that and ended up riding a troop ship back with people that were suffering from what they called then shell shock and today PTSD. My dad's sense of faith and trust in God, I don't think was shaken that much. What was shaken was his sense that the people that represented institutions or that represented themselves as trying to bring faith to help heal didn't do the job that he felt should be done. And so it was a presence. There were standards of behavior that adhered to those of Christianity, but it was something that in my rather unique fashion developed a little bit as I got older.
It's hard to pinpoint some things that may have just gradually, like the way the sun rises, when is it day?
Right.
Exactly. It's hard to know until maybe it hits you right in the eye when the sun finally comes up over the horizon. I'm just wondering what you feel like you know now that you didn't back then about faith.
One of the unique things that really developed my sense of faith and then led to it were two different incidents. One is I was fascinated by flying. I was for a while a flight instructor. And one of the seminal experiences that I had when I learned to fly on instruments above cloud decks, one day I remember flying over a low overcast deck, nothing but white cloud below me and blue sky above me. And there was a sense of infinity. And I had done it long enough that I had a sense of peace there. But it was just, I was both overwhelmed and felt very small, but felt very blessed at having this experience. Another time I was flying over a neighborhood and saw it was dusk. And you saw lights blinking on in houses. And I had the sense of separate lives in all these houses. And even though I was up at perhaps 2,000 to 3,000 feet, not very high, and they were down on the ground, I had the sense of connection and curiosity with what was going on in their lives and how were we connected. I began reading a lot of the authors, aviation authors, that had a philosophical bent. One was Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. A lot of people know him from having written The Little Prince. He wrote another one called The Airman's Odyssey. And one of the quotes, and I looked this up figuring we might end up covering this, is, "Let your dream devour your life, not your life devour your dream." And that was fundamental for me.
I just have to say, you've introduced me to a whole new subgenre of reading, which is philosophical musings of pilots.
You know, go to unique places, and I'm sure you've had this. You have beautiful places in Utah. In fact, I really love Terry Tempest Williams, and she talks about the holiness of place and sensing that where she is and in who she is and in the larger setting. She has been also instrumental.
And you will be moderating an upcoming faith and science conference in Rome, and I'm wondering first, just how did you get connected with that?
Like so many things, I think some of the best things in life happen just totally unscripted and just by happenstance. My wife and I were attending a program on Thomas Merton at St. Mary's College of Notre Dame, and we bumped into this other fellow, and we got to talking about our interest in contemplative Christianity and so forth, and it turned out that he was working to put this conference together. And as we spoke, he said, "You know, we really need a moderator." He said, "You seem like you've got a little experience in that." And he said, "You have a scientific background. Would you be interested? And by the way, it's scheduled to be in Rome." Well, what's not to like about that?
Well, besides just taking the temperature of the weather, I think you are also experienced at taking the temperature of various guests and various political issues over the years, as I've seen excerpts of, especially recent Challenge 2.0, where there's a lot going on these days to discuss.
There is. You know, I should mention that the origin of this program, the original challenge came out in the 60s and extended from 1960 to 1974, and it was basically a rabbi, a priest, and a Protestant pastor. It almost sounds like punchline to a story there, but they basically were looking at the polarization that existed even back then, and it was actually the rabbi's idea. And they said, "Why don't we get together and why don't we just discuss different contemporary issues and perhaps some elements of faith?" and see if we can't show people, number one, that we are people, that it doesn't necessarily match with their preconceived notions or prejudices, but then also see if we can't cover some interesting ground. Well, from having retreats at a retreat center that they founded, I came to know Father William Tracy, who is the Catholic priest on here, and he asked me to serve on the board of this organization. At that time, it was called the Tracy Levine Group. It's since been changed to Past Understanding. It is, as you pointed out very well, focusing on different faith traditions and wisdom traditions. You can operate, I think, in interfaith or in dealing with different wisdom traditions on a variety of different levels. One is certainly, essentially, this is my tradition, tell us about yours. But I think beyond that, what we really wanted to develop is the ability to look at contemporary issues through the lens of faith, through the lens of values, through the lens of ethics. And they recognize that in our community, and I suspect like most communities around the United States, the fastest growing proportion are those that identify themselves as being nuns, N-O-N-E-S,
right,
not affiliating with any faith tradition. So we made the decision to make a slight change in our approach, and that is rather than always have three faith leaders deal with issues, try to ask questions that are related to values, ethics, and faith, and then attack it from that standpoint. So that's what we've been doing. We are now finishing up our eighth year of production. And as you know, with the program that you do, it requires a lot of research. And you learn something, you grow, and we get positive feedback from people. Getting a different sense of issues and topics and impacts of those issues and topics that perhaps they didn't have before.
Well, I think it's really interesting. You focus in your program everything from corporate lawsuits against nonprofit groups, suicide trafficking of indigenous women, various initiatives and referendums. Those might not be a typical list of bullet points for an interfaith discussion, except you do make that happen. So can you give me an example or walk me through what when you
Sure.
have an issue, how you deal with that when you're actually looking at it from faith perspectives?
What I should mention is that, you know, in Christianity, we have, of course, the Sermon on the Plain, the Sermon on the Mount, the various standards that Jesus left us. But we also have that in terms of Judaism, what's called Tikkun Olam. And that's basically the principle of improving the earth, improving the lives of those who dwell here, and healing things that need to be healed. And I learned that even Islam, which I was not as familiar with, also has a similar, what they would call, communal responsibility toward the betterment of all people. And so I have a group of advisors that I work with and run topics by them, and certainly my co-producers on the program. And we say, does this make sense? And if so, what's the best approach? And so that's typically sort of the thought process that we go through. We know that in any discussion, what really connects people the most is connecting heart to heart and then the heart to the head. Personal stories. One of the hardest programs, and we did three different episodes, Steve, was on youth suicide. And we know that that's a growing problem, certainly
yes.
here in Washington State where I live, and I suspect in all states. And we had a case of two parents who lost their son. He was a star baseball player. He developed a medical problem. The medication he took not only affected his physical health, but it also impacted his mental state. And he ended up dying from suicide. And we thought the story was not just getting the parents to share their struggle and the story of their son's struggle with the hope that other young people that might be facing the similar situation, similar concerns, similar orientation, might not only get an idea of what help is out there, but also what the families deal with. We ended up having the family. We had some classmates, some teammates of the young man, and also some counselors, some people within both the medical profession and also within the counseling profession to talk about resources that they found were useful.
And maybe one of those ways is my next question. We see that you participate in contemplative outreach.
Yes.
This is something that I've been interested in and had the chance in a monastery in Berryville, Virginia, to be able to go to a silent retreat there and talking to others about meditation or contemplative prayer. I'm wondering if you could talk about different kinds of prayer. I think there's the spontaneous ones that we have in a condition of emergency, a situation.
Right.
But contemplative almost feels like observing or listening, which typically we think prayer is something that's got to come out of our mouth, or at least mentally out of our minds.
Right, discursive prayer.
But this seems different.
It is, and there are different forms for it. Within the overall range, there is the practice of Lectio Divina. Lectio Divina means reading scripture, or it can be any book that inspires you. And rather than reading through a paragraph or a page or a chapter, pick out something that really impacts you. And then ask yourself, what is it about that that really touches me? What word or phrase touches me? How do I reflect on that path or that word or phrase? Is there a prayer that comes to mind? And then just sit with that in silence. So Lectio Divina is also a very powerful way of doing that. There's Musica Divina, listening to a piece of music that touches you. And go through the same basic process with that. It can be a piece of art. It can be outside. I love hiking and skiing and scuba diving. And it's odd, but I've had some pretty profound moments submerged 80, 90 feet down. And all of a sudden you get struck. You don't forget to breathe. That's very important if you're diving. But it just opens you to different avenues of spiritual inspiration that you otherwise wouldn't have, perhaps. But what I would also say, I was diagnosed with PTSD as a result of the work we did down on Mount St. Helens. And I felt that my faith was expanding, but I just wasn't, I think, tapping the full richness of it or really getting that sense of contributing in the way in which I was being asked to contribute. And so one day I saw this contemplative outreach retreat teaching the practice of centering prayer, silent prayer, and I decided to take that. And I did, and I felt very enriched. And it's not an easy practice. As you know, sitting there, silent prayer is, you begin to get a little itchy, and you begin to think, well, how much longer do I have to go? It's said that God's first language is silence. It is not a matter of making your mind a blank. I always like, and I teach it, I will say that if you made your mind a blank, how would you know? It is not a matter of being without thoughts. It's being not attached to thoughts and recognizing that you let these thoughts come and you let them go. I had the wonderful opportunity to study under Father Thomas Keating. He said, it's a little bit like you're on the surface of a river and you're looking at things pass. And yes, you look at them, but then you change your focus and you focus on something else. You begin to find that you change. And one of the stories that I really like, the lady that actually taught me the initial method of centering prayer, told the story of one day her son said, Mom, have you done centering prayer lately? And she said, well, no, why? And he said, you know, you might take some time and do it today. He saw that it had made a change in her life that she didn't maybe totally recognize or appreciate herself. And again, I think it's opening ourselves more fully to the movement and the presence of the Holy Spirit within.
And their son had some people skills, not to say, because you're cranky today, Mom. I have to remember to say to people, it just occurs to me that you might be interested in contemplative prayer.
Yes, indeed.
Jeff, when you've had a chance to teach this to people, what have you seen happen to them? Or were they surprised by the experience?
They are. It's typically not what they expected. Some fall immediately into a sense of peace and greater depth, and some struggle. And I think the important thing when you're teaching this method is to elaborate on the fact that these are parts of the experience. It's part of the journey. But to stick with it, and over time, and I've been probably doing it probably 21, 22 years now, is that it changes you over time. It enriches your faith and puts you in a deeper place to appreciate gifts, but also to become, I think, a little bit more flexible and give you greater perspective when you run into the sources of suffering and pain that are inevitably a part of life.
I'm wondering if you have felt an increased sense of, I'm coming from my own bias here, my own experience, of an increased sense of trust, actually, that I don't see the whole plan, but I am going to be able to trust that someone is holding this.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on a very important point, and that is trust. I think how my faith has changed is I don't have a sense of who God is. In fact, I feel, if anything, it's become less important to me. I know God is present, but I have a sense of trust, and I will be the first one to explain that not at all times, not in all places, but in a general sense, I have a greater sense of trust that there's a greater presence working behind me, behind others, behind situations, and that things will out for the best. You know, we've seen a number of the mystics, I think it was Julian of Norwich said, all will be well and all will be well. Yeah. It's the sense that you have to take the long horizon. I think the other thing is just to view each of us, each of you, myself, as having a specific purpose that nobody else can fulfill. And just ask yourself, in my tradition, my faith tradition, they have what they call the Jesuit examen. And Jesuits are a branch of Catholicism. But it's basically at the end of the day to ask yourself, where did I make myself a better contributor to life around me? Where did I grow a little bit? And what do I need to work on? And I think that sense of personal mission is very key to getting a sense of progress and to getting a sense of satisfaction and fulfillment.
Because you've had a chance to speak with people of so many different faith traditions, that's been lovely for me. Being around so many people of faith strengthens my own faith because I see how God is working in their lives, which gives me faith that God is working in mine too. I'm just wondering what that whole experience has been for you.
I think my general sense of humanity is that it has deepened in a sense of appreciation over the number of good people, that they take different paths. Sometimes you'll hear from people, well, don't you fear that your personal faith will weaken if you're talking to all these other people of different faith paths? And I would agree with what you just said, Steve, and that is the answer is no. It deepens my own sense of appreciation. I have a good friend who's a rabbi, and I have a better sense of where Christianity, what the foundation was for that. It doesn't make me oriented at all to changing, but it gives me that greater sense of depth and peace and confidence. So I would definitely agree. And I think we all benefit from that because we inhabit the planet with people of a great variety of faith traditions, some none, and I think that's to their detriment, but there are many different reasons for that. And I think we have a better sense of where they're coming from.
Well, I was going to ask what connects you to the divine. So there's a couple. You talked about contemplative prayer, and it sounds like places, beautiful places or situations that inspire awe is another of those for you.
You know, there's a book out, and I must admit, I haven't read the whole thing yet, but it's on the power of awe and wonder. And when I do different talks, I will talk about the need to build a foundation. There was a story of a young woman who had graduated from college and went out seeking to change the world for the better. And she met up with one of her advisors, and he listened to her very patiently. And he said, you know, I don't think you have the foundation of prayer to sustain you in this work. You're going to burn out. And she thought, well, what does he know? And she walked off, continued doing what she was doing in terms of activism, but did burn out. And she came to recognize that that was very important to develop that sense of faith, that sense of connection, and that ongoing sense of inspiration and awe and wonder to be able to maintain that inspiration for her to keep active and for her to realize why, in a sense, she is, I would say, bedazzled by life.
Because you have worked in positions where you're an important part of the community, and with your discussion of current affairs and interfaith topics, what good things do you see happening because of the different faith groups working together in a community?
I see faith groups coming together, and one of the programs through Paths to Understanding, of which I'm a part, is what they call the Potluck Project. And what they do is they'll find some faith community and they'll say, this is what we're doing. We're not going to talk about anything that divides us. We're going to talk about personal experiences. And they'll reach out in the community and they'll draw in people from many different faiths. I was just participating in one in the community of Kirkland, and they had people from Judaism, from Islam, from the Sikh community. And then we had people that had been disaffected by their experience with faith. And we didn't get together to talk about that. We talked a little bit about what our background was, but what experiences we had that had shaken us, what experiences we had that built us up, what had discouraged us from connecting with different people, and what experiences we had that helped us connect with people. And I found that very powerful. And everybody, I think, walked out of that, and we had probably about 40 to 50 people in that, smiling, with a lighter sense and with a sense of greater personal safety in the sense of it's okay to engage with people who might be different than you are.
Many thanks to Jeff Renner for generously sharing his faith. Did you know we have a new podcast? Join Heather Bigley on VoiceOver, Movies That Move Us, for discussions of cinematic epiphanies. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the BYU Radio app. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, and James Sturtevant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Subscribe to the YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith. Hi, this is Stephen Cap Perry, and I'd love to recommend one of our BYU Radio family of podcasts for you. It's called The Appleseed. It's filled with stories for you and your family. Every episode features really excellent, nationally known storytellers sharing all kinds of folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family stories. It's great to put on and listen to for road trips or bedtime for kids, or anytime you want something to get the whole family not only listening, but then those stories generate conversations. And it's so easy to say, hey, do you have a story about this? Or, oh, that reminds me of when grandma said, or whatever it might be. Check out the Appleseed podcast. You'll have fun and you might learn some new stories from your own family members.